your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Yeah, how you doing, Charlotte? You're sounding great, babe.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, things are going good up here in the Midwest.
We have this evening with us one of the finest guests that I would say that we've ever had, because the issue is so is paramount to national security and to what's good about America, you know, and it's very a critical issue that we're talking about 9/11. And this lady has done an in-depth research and writing of 20 different articles for A&E 9/11truth.org. And the title of the articles was "Why Do Good People Become Silent or Worst?" She's got an MA, and also she's a licensed professional counselor also out of Colorado. Welcome to our program, Fran Schur.
Thank you so much, George.
Tell our listening audience a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll begin.
My background, as you said, I have a master's degree in counseling psychology. I've worked in a private practice as a psychotherapist, and that's the part of my background that really pertains to this, as well as. Actually being one of the I was very early on very suspicious of the official story of 9/11, although I did believe the official story, like most of us did. And, but I received a DVD, from, Michael Rupert, in the fall of 2001, which questioned the official story, and then later on the book, The War on Freedom, by Nafis Mosaddegh Ahmed, which really went in depth in a lot of research showing that we haven't been told the truth about 9/11. And I just got started and didn't stop. I co-founded Colorado 9/11 Truth, and we're still working hard to educate the public about this evidence.
There's been a recent documentary, right, that you were part of, I think, out of Colorado. I've seen that. You gave me a link, and I watched it the other day, and that was an excellent presentation, and I want to thank you for being part of that.
Thank you, George. I think you're talking about Demolition of Truth, Psychologists Examine 9/11.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that was, in fact, your listeners can find that. It's still streaming at cpt12.org. That's cpt12.org/9/11. And it will be streaming for a year. We were very, very happy. Chuck Smith was the filmmaker, and several of us, Marty Hopper and I, worked pretty closely with him in the editing of that film. And luckily, Colorado Public Television thought it was a very good film and showed it, and they had a lot of positive response for that film. We were very, very happy with the results.
Yeah, I was very, very happy with what I saw, that you know, the way that you testified, and also the other people that testified about 9/11 truth.
Uh-huh.
And so forth. Let's get back to this series of articles. The overall name was "Why Do Good People Become Silent or Worse About 9/11?
Yeah, why do good people become silent or worse about 9/11? And it basically comes a serial essay that may become a book. We hope so eventually. And this essay basically combines this research from the social sciences plus clinical observation, my own clinical observation, and it kind of combines that those observations and research into the issue of 9/11 and why people don't know about this issue and why when they do know about it, it's so difficult for them to get their heads around it.
You know, the one of the most important points is when you first hear about an event like this, doesn't that make a major imprint or an impression on the viewer or the listening audience, the initial description or the reason, the cause of it? Is that a very important factor?
When you talk, for example, when people haven't heard anything about this and they first hear about it, it's definitely a shock to basically almost anyone in any American because of many, many reasons. First of all, the official story has become very ingrained in our psyche. We have accepted it as true. And then we also believe our country is basically good, and that's what we talk about as American exceptionalism. That's what David Ray Griffin has alerted us all to, and I've spoken about in my essay. We believe our country is basically a good, and that even though our leaders may do some bad things, their intentions are always good. And we're just finding that the evidence does not support that.
Right, so it creates a system of denial, and many of Americans are still in denial. And you bring up this subject of cognitive dissonance. Is that sort of operative in many people's minds still?
It's operative for all of us because it's what I write about in my essay is not about just some people. It's about all of us. We all have certain human tendencies, and one of those tendencies is that when we hear information that contradicts a belief system that we have, we become uncomfortable and we become agitated and uncomfortable and we want to resolve that discomfort. And one way to resolve the discomfort is simply to deny the evidence that's coming our way, to just say it's not true, we don't look at it, or we try to minimize it. And that's one way of trying to stick to our original belief system and therefore feel comfortable. And as I've said before, another way for people who especially are more data-oriented people, we look at the evidence and we go through the discomfort and then we rearrange our belief system to suit the facts.
Yes, you also.
Oh, and it was painful. We used to, George, excuse me.
Yeah,
we used to, back in 2006, 2007, and sooner than that, people would talk about in my culture, waking up, you know, and how they would freak out or whatever, that feel like the world was going in reverse for a week or something. And people would tell their stories about going through cognitive dissonance and coming to the realization that something terrible, you know, is going on. And it was a very sobering experience. I personally think I went through cognitive dissonance about a week in myself, you know, because I happened to be on active duty serving in the Texas Army National Guard when 9/11 happened. So I didn't have much to do except prepare for war. And in fact, my sister ended up going. And just the whole cognitive dissonance phenomena that people now they call it waking up or whatever. But back in the day, it was waking up meant you went through the cognitive dissonance and you accepted the evidence.
Right.
That's right. That's right. And you know, Charlotte, it's really, I think it's traumatic when we have such a strong faith in our country as being a good country and not capable of this sort of thing. It's really a trauma for us to discover evidence to the contrary, and we have to heal that trauma. We have to resolve it, And hopefully many of us have done that, because we now know that there are many, many people, not only around the world, but in our own country, who do not believe the official story. I think the latest poll, I heard this from Les Jamieson, was from the Rasmussen Report, that I think it was back in April, and the Rasmussen Report, which is a scientific poll, said that 74% of Americans, that's three-quarters of Americans, wanted all of the evidence about 9/11 released.
Right. Charlotte and I have been pushing for a reinvestigation of 9/11 for at least 10 years, haven't we, Charlotte, or longer?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, the two things that we're talking about when we're talking about cognitive dissonance in concerning 9/11, the two ideas would be that it was carried off the way the government's portraying it. And then the other conflicting idea is that maybe there was an inside job here, or the government knew something about it before the event. Those are the two opposing ideas. Is that right?
Right. So what you're saying, George, is one is the official story is true.
Right, right.
Just like they say.
Right.
Another theory is that it was really just an intelligence failure, and it was incompetence on the part of the government.
Right.
That
right.
A lot of people believe that. And then beyond that, other people believe that 9/11 was known by some people and allowed to happen.
Right.
And that's what's called the Lee Hop, the let it happen on purpose theory.
Right.
And then beyond that is the theory of made it happen on purpose, which
I
is
see.
That the government, there are elements, now I'm not saying the government, but elements within the government and our military, actually planned and executed.
Conspired together to carry this event. Yeah,
they actually orchestrated it. So there are those different theories. And
right.
Of course, I'm in the last category. I believe the evidence clearly shows
right.
beyond a doubt that elements within our government and our military orchestrated
right.
9/11.
But you know, you get back also in one of your articles. Mm-hmm. There's about believing authority, right? I mean,
yes.
we get uh-huh. up every morning and go to school and say our pledge to the allegiance of the, you know, to the flag of the United States. And so all of that stuff over years and decades builds up this American exceptionalism, or, well, of course, your older people today are still into that, but your younger people are not. But anyway, this authority figure, the government says this, people are still tied to that a little bit, but you're saying 75% of the people are open to something else and want more investigation, right?
Yes. That 74%, according to the poll, the Rasmussen report, says that not 74% want all of the evidence to be released. And
okay.
this poll was done after the 60 Minutes program on the 28 pages.
Okay.
So the 28 pages really is playing a role for us that is important, in that it's opening people's minds to the fact that there may be way more to this story about 9/11 than they've been told.
Well, I think you make a very important point there. And also, AE911truth.org begin to focus on Building 7, which opened up a lot of people's minds to something else is going on there on that site.
That's right. Yeah, they're very happy.
And
they're focusing on World Trade Center 7. It's very important.
Right. So I think A&E 9/11 Truth and Richard Gage and his group contributed in that manner, even though there are people that are in opposition to that particular theory now, like Jim Fetzer and others. But we can touch on that later. How does doublethink differ with cognitive dissonance?
Well, that's a great question. Doublethink, in a way, it's the opposite of cognitive dissonance. They're both
right.
defense mechanisms. Cognitive dissonance, cognitive dissonance is really the discomfort we feel when we receive information that invalidates our belief system.
Right.
Denial is what we use to avoid cognitive dissonance.
Right.
So denial is a defense mechanism.
Sure.
We're in a state of dissonance, discomfort when we have two conflicting theories about what reality is. That's cognitive dissonance.
Right.
with doublethink, it's kind of the opposite. And this is not a psychological term. I put it in because I believe there is reality to it.
Yes.
And I've seen it in operation myself. And doublethink is George Orwell's term from his book 1984. And this doublethink occurs when we hold two conflicting beliefs at the same time. And we use one or the other depending on the situation. And for example, you know, I stated in my essay, there was a friend of mine, a woman who spoke up as though she believed the official story, but I knew she did not believe the official story.
Right.
And she was speaking in terms of believing the official story. And when I confronted her on this, she said, got pretty angry with me, and she said, well, what am I to do? We're surrounded with the official story. It's everywhere. You know, it's in our schools, it's in our newspaper, it's everywhere. What am I to do? So she was talking as though the official story were correct in this particular situation when she obviously did not believe the official story. So in a way, she held two conflicting beliefs at the same time, and she used them depending on the situation she was in.
Right.
So it's another defense mechanism, really, even though the psychology profession doesn't recognize it. It's a defense mechanism to make ourselves feel more comfortable.
Well, I think it's being fed by overlying ideas like social and moral relativism. See what I mean? Situation ethics and things like that. I think those concepts that have been widely taught in our schools and so forth support a double-think type of attitude. That's what
mm-hmm.
I see.
Interesting. Okay.
Anyway, also, we have the conformity. Well, first, let's put it this way. How about new ideas? How do new ideas take hold in a society? Is there resistance to anything new and that the public in general has, a resistance to anything new that's not in conformity with previous thought ideas?
Well, you know what I address the how do new ideas get into society
general
through the second part of my essay called Diffusion of Innovations.
Right.
This is actually, this diffusion of innovations is actually an anthropological study. And what these anthropologists have found out is that in any society, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be a traditional society in Peru. It could be technological-oriented people in the U.S., it can be any society, but what they found is that when a new idea comes into that society, the first people that grab a hold of that new idea and start talking about it are what's called the innovators. And these wind up being only about 2.5% of the population.
Right.
So let's apply that to 9/11. Let me see if I can think of examples. Who would be the innovators of 9/11? Is a new idea. The 9/11 truth. The fact, the evidence, or the theory that we have not been told the truth about 9/11. That's a pretty shocking and pretty new idea. So who are the innovators in our time? Well, I think Michael Rupert would be one.
Right.
I think Nafis Mossadegh Ahmed would be another. They were the very first people to come out and say the evidence doesn't support the truth, and they stood on their two feet and said, here's the evidence that we see.
Right.
Now, then the next group of people in a society are called the early adopters. And these are the people that generally are looked up to in a society. They look at the innovators and they say, yeah, there seems to be something to this. And so we're going to start talking about this too. And in ours, well, let's say in 9/11, who would those people be? They're people who are respected in society, who other people will listen to. I think David Ray Griffin would be a good example of that.
Right.
He's a person who's very well respected, who looked at the evidence and said, yes, there's something here. Let's see, who else would that be? I think actually there are a lot of prominent people.
Well, the architects and engineers that are professional people.
Yeah, Richard Gage is another one. A lot of people who signed the truth petition in the early days.
Right.
Daniel Ellsberg was one. And so then people listen to these early adopters, and Stephen Jones is very definitely an early adopter.
Yeah.
And they look at the next group is called the early majority, and that's 34% of the population.
Okay.
The early majority are the people who then say, okay, we respect these people. We respect David Ray Griffin. We respect Richard Gage, Daniel Ellsberg, and we are going to now look at the evidence, and we agree with it. So now you've reached half of the population. You know,
right?
Then that's what's called the late majority, is another 34%, and these people really come on board mostly because it's practical to do so. And then the very last is what's called the laggards. That's 16% of the population. These people may never accept the new idea in the society.
Very skeptical about anything.
Yeah, they will never accept it, and there's all sorts of reasons why they won't, and that's one of the things I've explored in my essay.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. You've really written some fine articles here, and we have them listed on our site right now this evening, and we so people can go in there, and they can also click on that documentary out of Colorado, and then your articles also are very, very important. You get into conformity and the spiral of silence. Tell us a little bit of how that works.
Conformity, that is one of my favorite parts of the essay, one of my favorite things to research. It's fascinating. There is Solomon Asch. Was the psychologist who he's out of Swarthmore College, and he did some very classic experiments on conformity. He took a group of people, a group of students, and all of them were what they call confederates. They were in on the scheme, on the trick, they were in on the deception.
Okay.
And they so there'd be like a group of these students who would be shown two cards. One card would have three lines on them, and the second card would have one line. And what the students were to do were to match up the card with one line to which line on the other card it matched. It's very, very easy thing to do. It's extremely easy to see which line matches up. And then they would have what they call the naive student, the subject. And the subject would be the subject of the experiment. That person would come in, and every person in the group would give the wrong answer.
Okay.
Something is very, very
easy. They were
easy
in
to
on
see.
It, right?
They would choose the long line instead of the line that matched up, for example.
Okay.
And so then what they found is that with the subjects, even though the subject knew which was the right line to choose, this 36% I think 36.8% of the subjects would deny their own correct perception, and they would go along with the majority. So what it shows is that we humans, and this is true for all of us, we have a very, very strong tendency to conform to the group.
Right.
And we see that in every day. I mean, most of us want to be like our peers. We want to drive a car that's similar to our peers. We want houses that are similar to our peers. We want to dress in a way that's similar to our peers.
Right.
So it's part of keeping society functioning in a smooth and smooth way. But then, of course, it reaches a place of maladjustment in which we make very bad decisions if we conform. Not sticking to our own beliefs, our own perception of reality.
So you call this maladaptive form of conformity what, like groupthink and hive thinking and Think yeah. like that, huh?
And that's a groupthink is another maladaptive form yeah. of
right.
conformity.
Sure.
In which we, and because we don't want to be rejected, we want to be part of a group, we don't want to be isolated, we will tend to go along with whatever the group thinks. And so I think we take that to 9/11, and we see that since the majority of the people, our authorities tell us what reality is, that there were 19 Muslims that attacked us, and that's all there was to it because they hate our freedoms.
Yeah, and they put their photographs up on the newspapers pretty quickly.
Right, very quickly. And so the majority of the people being in a state of shock, you know, because we've been attacked in a most horrendous way, agree with authority. And then the newspapers, the media, and the television all validate that explanation from the government. So then the majority of the people, because we like to go along with the majority, we like to be on the in crowd, we accept that theory, you know.
Sure.
So we have such a strong tendency, all of us, to conform.
Right. You know, could you describe this as trauma-based programming in a way? What happened to the masses? It was a traumatic experience.
Yes.
It got to people's deep psyche areas, so it hurt them.
Yes.
It made them mad as hell, and they wanted that. What their response was hatred and resentment on those people that attacked us. That's sort of the way I see it, in a way.
That's right, and I think I would agree with you on that. I would just have to know a little bit what you mean by trauma-based programming, but it sounds like I would probably agree with you on that. We were in a state of shock.
Right.
We were scared, and when people are scared, when fear is prominent, that's when atrocities happen. And then that fear leads to our anger. Because see, our anger is really, for the most part, our anger is a defense against the fear. We don't want to feel fear. We don't want to feel helpless and vulnerable. So we become angry, and that's a way to defend ourselves from feeling helpless and vulnerable and fearful. So then our anger says, let's roll. You know, let's go get them. We don't really even care who it is. Let's just go get somebody. We'll just let our authorities tell us who we should go get. And of course, we know now. I mean, it's now very clear to most people who have their eyes open at all that we were lied to about going to war in Iraq.
Yes.
We were lied to about weapons of mass destruction. And we were lied to that there was any connection whatsoever between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. There was no connection at all, and there were no weapons of mass destruction. But that's what settled in the public's mind. And unfortunately, most of the young men and women who signed up very patriotically to go into war in Iraq believed those stories.
Right.
You know, they were going for very good reasons. They were patriotic. They wanted to defend our country, but they were being deceived by our government.
That first night after 9/11, that evening, I was sitting at a restaurant out in South Alton on Munchak Road, we call it, mm-hmm. and there were these truck young men in their trucks, and their pickup trucks, going up and down the road at a fast speed with a Texas flag and an American flag flying out the back of their truck.
Mm-hmm.
And they were mad as hell. That's sort of an example of how upsetting that the 9/11 was.
That's right. And most people, you know, young men like that who, you know, can kind of have a macho type personality.
Yes, exactly.
They don't want to admit that they're afraid, you know.
Right,
fear,
right.
Fear is really at the basis of all of this.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, no. But we have to, once we become aware of our fear and we're not afraid to look at our own fear, we can become much more conscious, you know, much more in touch. But we don't want to be, a lot of us don't want to be in touch with our fear, so then we just let our anger take over. And we all remember those days when everybody under the sun was wearing a flag lapel pin, and they were wearing the flag on every area of their body, you know, and proclaiming their patriotism in that way.
Yeah, that fear also, fear of our death, is tied into some of these dynamics too, isn't it?
Yes, you're right. You're right. And that was another essay part. That was what's called terror management theory. It's
right.
Psychologists have looked into that, and what they have discovered by doing research is that anytime anyone mentions any subject that reminds them of their death, they tend to want to not receive that information. They want to manage their terror, basically, and it's called terror management theory.
Right. Charlotte, did you experience some of these people around you at the time of 9/11 that were mad as hell, or what kind of impression did you get at that day?
Well, not to take us too far back, but I did experience the doublethink with a neighbor. I went over and talked to him. Yeah, I went over and talked to him about 9/11, and I showed him the evidence that I had been presented with, and that was simple physics. You know, buildings cannot come down that fast. Mm-hmm. And he agreed with me. He was friendly, and he seemed to take in the new information. And in the same conversation, he snapped back to his old thing. Well, I'm not interested in knowing. And I, you know, he agreed with me, but he also, when the door closed, I knew I hadn't reached him because he was still very defensive to it. And yes, there's a lot of macho, you know, patriotism, you know, after Saddam, or was it Saddam? It was over in Afghanistan, the people that felt that Osama bin Laden.
In my community, they
loaded in the back of pickup trucks and went downtown and flew flags and hollered and honked horns and, you know, we got Osama bin Laden. But that had nothing to do, from my perspective, anyways, with 9/11, because I've looked at evidence to the contrary, and I feel very certain that I don't know that the man was innocent of being a good person or you know, a bad person, but Osama bin Laden was not behind 9/11 the way that I see it happening.
Right.
And so to see them, you know, the celebrating something so false was just—it was disheartening.
I know it is. It is sad, isn't it, Fran? To be. I mean, don't you have one experience where you, where a woman said, "Yeah, that might be right, but I don't want to go there." Something like that.
A lot of experiences like that.
Yeah, right. They just don't want to go there because it's upsetting, and they don't want to hear it.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, in the beginning, it's so frustrating to me. Now, as I've kind of looked at this and thought about it and basically continued with my own healing journey around this, because I think we all have to do a lot of healing around this.
Yes,
we do. Absolutely. That's an important point.
And I'm no exception. You know, I've had to do a lot of healing around it. But, you know, eventually we find compassion for these people because we realize that they are very, very disturbed and they are in crisis. They're in crisis.
Yes,
and,
they are.
And we really have to go slow and be very compassionate and listen to them because they're going to want to vent, you know. And then, you know, after they vent, we can provide a piece of evidence or two or a DVD and just say, just give me your feedback on this, you know, and just stay with them in a compassionate way.
If we're patient with people, that's love.
See? Yeah, exactly.
The way I see these people, they're in a deluded state, state of delusion, meaning that they've been tricked into thinking something that's not really right on. See what I mean?
Right. And often that false belief is, as we talked about, it's part of American exceptionalism, part of nationalist faith, our faith in our nation, that reaches an almost religious kind of level. And it's part of our identity, too. I mean, we see ourselves as good people. We see ourselves as Americans are good people. They would never do such things. So it becomes part of our identity So we're shaken to the core by this information.
Right. There's another idea on one of your articles there. It was called signal detection theory. Is that where there's just a lot of noise out here and we have a trouble trying to, move through the noise and filter through the noise and get to the real essence of truth or what? How does that work?
Yeah, that was actually a new one for me. It's something
right.
I didn't learn about in school, but it was something that another psychology person pointed out to me. So I did some research into it and found out that there's been a lot of research in what they call signal detection theory. And
right.
that's when it shows, basically it says that whenever people are making a decision, there's
right.
always uncertainty involved.
Sure.
And that uncertainty has to do with what they call the noise all around them. That noise can be external or it can be internal. If it's internal, it's, for example, someone who is so thoroughly indoctrinated in our belief in American exceptionalism and that Americans would never do such a thing. Or it could be that a person who has a mental health problem, like, for example, bipolar disorder, or it could be a person who just has a lot of trauma in their life right now. So they've got too much going on. There's too much noise to listen
right.
to our signal, which is what we want them to hear. We want them to get that we haven't been told the truth about 9/11, you know. And or the noise could be there's just so much going on outside. There's too many bombings going on in our country that worries them. They might have a sick child. There's too much going on externally, which prevents them from really focusing on what we're saying and hearing the signal. This is called signal detection theory.
That's good. What comes to my mind is something like autism. A characteristic
mm-hmm.
of some autistic people is where they can't filter out the background that well. It all comes rushing into their mind, and they
uh-huh.
have not the ability to detect the most important things that they need to focus on.
Uh-huh.
And so that sort of goes. And the signal to noise, too, I think came out of the electronic industry. See?
Yes, I believe it did.
The signal
uh-huh.
detection theory came from the signal uh-huh. to noise, where there's always background noise out there, and so you have to dwell and try to focus. The mind has the ability to focus in on just really important aspects of all reality very intensely if they're not suffering some ailment. See what I mean?
Right.
That's a problem. So, okay, and then also you're talking about prior knowledge or state crimes against democracy. Isn't that one of your friends that came up with some state crimes against democracy and deep politics? That's very interesting.
Right. I'm so grateful to the professor from Florida State University. His name is Lance DeHaven Smith. We had him out to talk. It was one of my favorite speakers that came out to talk to us in Denver. He wrote a book called Conspiracy Theory in America. And in this book, he basically, he does two things in general. One is he tells us the very interesting story about how the term conspiracy theory actually became a pejorative in our culture. And it was actually a CIA operation to discredit anyone who didn't believe an official story by the government. So there's just in essence, that was one thing he said in his, one thing he researched in his book. The other thing was he coined a term called state crimes against democracy. And he looked at the patterns of high crime in the American government. And, for example, he looked at the Iran-Contra affair. He looked at Watergate. And he said, let's don't use the term conspiracy theory anymore because that really stops all conversation. A much better term would be state crimes against democracy, which is a term that we can use to describe, events by, high crimes by the elite or the government, and those are sometimes not separate, in order to encourage research, encourage conversation, and it encourages to do research into the patterns that underlie all of these state crimes against democracy. So he sees 9/11 as very light. He really does believe that 9/11 was a false flag operation, was a state crime against democracy.
Right.
And the JFK assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, he explores all of these. The Robert Kennedy assassination, he explores all of these, and he says, "Look, there's patterns here. The anthrax attacks right after 9/11, and for example, one of the patterns he sees is that usually state crimes against democracy, such as 9/11, do not happen as a single event. They usually happen as either in pairs or in clusters. So he, for example, he says 9/11 didn't happen alone. There was then the anthrax attack that happened just after 9/11.
Yes, just
so
shortly after that. Yeah.
We really should be talking about not just 9/11, but the 9/11 anthrax attacks and the anthrax attacks. Because they came together, they served a similar, they served the same purpose, really, which was to terrorize the American public.
Right. They fed the terror about both things, didn't they?
That's right. Yeah.
I
love his work. Very, very groundbreaking book, Conspiracy Theory in America. And
right.
I think every American, if not every person, should really read this book.
Right, those ideas about conspiratorial people and all that. My one of my references comes out of the JFK thing. I think that's what they created it to cover people that were involved in researching the JFK assassination. But anyway, all of this results in helplessness. You wrote a couple of articles about being helpless and there's nothing we can do. Sort of give us your comments on that. Those ideas, those two articles.
Right. A learned helplessness is a very well-established phenomenon in the area of psychology.
Sure.
It's really just terrible and fascinating to see that what the research shows, and this was Martin Seligman who did this initial research, and what he did was by shocking dogs that were in a cage and could not escape the shock. It was an inescapable traumatic situation.
Okay.
And these two-thirds of these dogs then developed what's called learned helplessness. In other words, then when they would be exposed to a traumatic situation that they could escape, they didn't try to escape.
Oh, my gosh.
So they would be put in a box where they could escape. There would be shocks on one side, but they could jump over a barrier and escape to the other side where there were no shocks. But these dogs would not escape the shock. They lay down and whined and became helpless.
Oh, man. God.
So what they've discovered is this applied to other animals, and it also applies to humans.
Right.
And but what's interesting is that one third of the dogs, once they were subjected to this learned helplessness experiment, this inescapable shock, that those one third of those dogs did actually learn how to jump the barrier and to get away from the shock.
Right.
So they hypothesize that why did that one third learn how to escape? And they hypothesized that those dogs had some experience in their past where they, on their own, with their own efforts, and that was key, with their own efforts, they managed to resolve an inescapable situation. They managed
to
survive.
You're talking about individualism then, aren't you, in a way?
Yes, we are.
Huh?
And people have individual nervous systems, and we're all individuals.
Sure.
So then they see this. So then how I applied this is I've had so many people tell me And I've been a little bit of a scribe in this way, that every time someone would tell me their initial impression when I talked to them about 9/11, I would write it down, because there is something very important in their very words and the energy of their response that was so revealing to me and so truthful. So I would write it down, and that became part of the basis of my essay. But I would run into a lot of people who would say, you know, this is just too big for me.
Right.
I can't do anything about this. History's just going to have to take its course. There's nothing I can do about this. It's way too big for me. So I started wondering, could these people be victims of learned helplessness?
Right,
they know
right.
this exists.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know for each individual if they are or not. You know, it could be other things.
Sure.
But I do know from my clinical experience that when we have overwhelming trauma, especially very early on, especially as an infant or
right.
as a toddler, we can be conditioned to this phenomenon of learned helplessness, so that then we react to events in the future as though they are inescapable, as though
right.
they're permanent and not temporary. So, anyway, if it's just something I think actually applies to more people than we'd like to think in our culture.
Well, you talk about trauma in a young person. We're talking about DID then, aren't we? Dissociative Identity Disorder. And how does that filter into this? How does that relate to the 9/11? Do you have any ideas on that?
Yes, and I did write about that too. And
right.
It's another phenomenon, and it's another defense. Learned helplessness is actually a defense when you
right.
think about it. But dissociation, or dissociative identity disorder, DID,
right.
is actually a different kind of defense. And this is this occurs when there is so much just unspeakable horror and trauma that happens to a young child.
Right.
For example, ongoing and horrible sexual abuse, you know.
Right.
That the person splits into multiple personalities.
Right.
And that's what we call DID, or dissociative identity disorder.
Right.
And,
well, the previous name to this was MPD, multiple personality disorder.
Yeah. Multiple personality was the previous term.
Term for DID, right?
Right, yeah. right. So that's the extreme of
right.
that particular defense. But we all dissociate to one degree or another,
right.
you know, and,
yeah.
Most of us, you know, we're just really tired and we're just too stressed out, and we'll just kind of go somewhere else if someone's trying to talk to us about something we don't want to hear. But then there are people who actually have real trauma, but they don't have dissociative identity disorder, but they have had enough trauma in their lives that when we then talk about something that's very uncomfortable, which the 9/11 information is extremely uncomfortable for most people, you'll see these people's, their eyes will widen, they'll lose contact with us, they'll change the subject, so these people are actually experiencing dissociation.
Yes,
So if we can learn to identify
that. They're becoming
that,
detached, aren't they? They're drifting away from us.
They're drifting
becoming,
away from us. If
yes,
we can just
right.
understand that and
right.
and have some compassion, then we just figure out what to do, whether it's right to continue or not, and later on. So.
Well, how about this false self? We've got about 10 minutes to go
okay.
here.
Okay, okay.
The false self, and how does that figure into some of your thoughts on 9/11?
Okay, so this, in some ways, it relates to American exceptionalism or nationalist faith. The false self, if as infants and as young children, we get our needs met by our parents, we are seen as individuals for who we are, then we can develop what's called a real self.
Right.
And we feel solid and whole as human beings, and
right.
therefore when we can be very authentic as people. But many of us don't receive that. And we, our parents, for example, the classic case is the mother or the father who needs their child to be just like they are. They will only recognize characteristics that validate their own personality. And so these people never develop what's called a real authentic self. They develop a false self. They develop right. an image of who they are.
Well, it's these predispositions, see, that become ingrained in us. See,
yeah, exactly.
We can't overcome.
This yeah. can be to the extreme
right.
so that we don't even have any sense at all about an authentic self. All we
exactly.
know, all we know is our image of who we are. This is what we think we are, is our image. You know, we're the most handsome, the most beautiful, the smartest, whatever our image is, or it could be another image. It could be the opposite. It could be, you know, we're a criminal. That could be our image. You know, we're a bad person. Because that's what our family needs us to be. So we don't have an authentic self. We just have a false self. But sometimes this false self, and often this false self includes our identity with the United States of America as the best country on earth.
Right.
And then when someone comes along and says there's a lot of evidence that shows we're not the best country on earth, that we, you know, our government has done a lot of terrible things, have perpetrated a lot of state crimes against democracy for many, many years, then we can be, we can't hear it because it's attacking our own identity.
Sure, sure. Right, because our self is associated with a country.
Yes, you know, exactly.
I think. Well, yeah. I look at the false self as a something that originates in all of us from our development from young children onward. But that's one of my, I wrote a little book about that one time. But anyway,
uh-huh.
we also yeah. discuss this part number 20, those who lack conscience and empathy. You've described the sociopaths, but there's also psychopaths, is it not?
Well, it depends on who you listen to.
Right.
I listened to a woman. I read her book, The Sociopath Next Door.
Okay.
And
I mean,
I read many things, but
yes,
what I discovered was that I think it was Martha Stewart. I'm trying to remember her name right here. I think I've got it right. But some psychologists will say there's a difference between sociopathy and psychopathy, and
right.
others will say no, it's really the same thing. And
right.
and so I just took the position that it's really basically the same thing. It's basically we're speaking of people who lack a conscience. They don't have
yes,
a conscience,
yes.
and they lack empathy. They are
right.
not capable of empathy. In fact, the research shows that their brains are different, and they actually don't have the capacity for empathy. They're
right.
missing something. Something in their brains is different, and they don't even have the capacity for empathy. That's the true sociopath. There's a lot of people who may look like sociopaths. For example, people with narcissistic personality disorder may look like a sociopath,
sure.
but they're really not.
Okay.
And they, so the true sociopath doesn't even have the ability to find empathy for other people. So, for example, one of the things we have to look at, let's look at, some people would say automatically, well, Hitler's got to be a psychopath or sociopath.
Right.
Well, when you look at his what the characteristics of a true sociopath are, is a very cold, calculating, personality. One
right.
person who does not have any empathy for anyone.
Right.
A narcissistic personality disordered person won't be that way. They have very hot, passionate emotions.
Right.
And you'll
go ahead.
You'll usually find a lot of trauma in that person's background. You look at Hitler, he had horrendous trauma.
Right.
And as a child, he was beaten every day by his father to the point of near death.
Oh, my God.
He had huge trauma, and he became a very, very perverted personality because of that.
Right.
But I don't believe he was a true sociopath. So,
right. Okay.
So that's the difference.
Well, we've got about 3 minutes. Any concluding comments, Charlotte?
Oh, it's been fascinating. Thanks for having me here to listen. I wanted to say, you know, waking up, that the whole coming out of the cognitive dissonance and then
right.
waking up and then identifying the sociopath and the psychopath that seem to be
right.
in power. You know, that whole experience, you know, it's very tough for people in the 9/11 truth movement. They got a lot to process through.
Right, right.
To get to a healing place, but it's just, you know, I'm just 15 years on and we're still fighting for 9/11 truth.
We can't give up though. We got to keep going.
I don't have any of the answers, I'm afraid, but no, I just am very grateful that you had me here to listen, and I've learned some more stuff, so thank you.
Well, we've got 2.5 minutes, Fran, for your concluding remarks. We appreciate you being with us, too.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed it, and I'm trying to think. I don't think I have any concluding remarks.
Go ahead.
I guess I will say that the next segment of this essay
okay.
is going to be on the role of the media and then on the role of propaganda. The next
yes,
segment.
Yeah. Oh, God,
and
that ought to be good.
We have to realize that basically everything I'm talking about would not be so powerful. All of these defense mechanisms would not be so powerful if our media had done its job as the fourth estate. In our culture.
Yes.
If the media had immediately started, and there was many things they could question, you know, right at the beginning, how do they know these 9/11 Muslims were the hijackers? What is their evidence? And then on through to the nanothermite that was found in the dust.
There were
so many things that the media could have reported on, but our media is now really very highly controlled, both from without and from within the media. And I'm talking about the mainstream media mostly and many alternative media,
sure.
That they are not fulfilling their role as the investigators of our government's stories. They are simply being the loyal stenographers of our government. They are being the lapdogs, not the watchdogs. So had they done their job, I would probably not even be writing this essay.
Right. What'd you say, Charlotte?
Well, the Smithsonian Channel, the History Channel, all the channels that I visited this past anniversary of 9/11, I was offended yet again by the inept misinformation, disinformation, lack of information, lying by omission. I mean, I turned
right.
the television off. The propaganda is still strong.
It is very powerful, and that is a good goal on this next go-around, Fran Schur. And I want to thank you for being with us this evening and all the hard work and dedication you have to 9/11 Truth.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you both, George and Charlotte. Thank to you for the same reason.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and good night.
Okay, good night.
Well, Charlotte, we wrap up another one. We'll talk to you later, okay?
All right, thanks, George. Bye.
Thank you for all your hard work, Charlotte. Okay, bye-bye.
All right.
Good night.